class, now you know why. Because the absence of music is harder to start a class. When you do have music, you can stop playing the music and stop playing after that unnatural hush all across the room. And now I just have to give a stupid explanation like why we play music in order to get various villages with that hush. So, welcome back from Thanksgiving. Sorry for those of you who missed the class the day before Thanksgiving, in which all was revealed. So I'm sorry you couldn't be here for that. Maybe some of your classmates will really think about those calls. Also, a 3-com dongle was left in the room. I know that sounds vaguely obscene, but a 3-com dongle was left in the room last Monday. If anybody wants to claim the dongle, I believe it's AP has it. If you don't know what a dongle is, chances are good you are not missing it. And of course, the papers will be Wednesday. Up on the website, you'll see instructions as to how to turn them in. Captain Harris has agreed to be staffing the office. It'll do exactly 5 p.m. Please don't make me a circus out of it by trying to turn them in at 5:01. So I'll try to put it on the site and I'll send an email out to the class about it too. Okay, so with all that, today is one of two of our four remaining classes, which have been put together and in large part led by students, by those of you who have stepped forward to do it. So Stephen Hart and Aaron Huffman helped put the class together. You see they are wired with the portable lab lights. I'm stuck among these flimsy glow worlds. So it's sort of over to them for today's stuff. Tomorrow we have a guest. Next Monday is the other student run class, and then next Tuesday is the last class of the term. Please hold your heels until the very end of the class on that. I am quite sad that it's already over. And there's also a reception, I believe, next Monday, a week from today, sort of an end of the class reception, and something for Don Collage will be coming to visit that day. So mark your calendars now to stay a little later on Monday night and celebrate the bittersweet fact of the ending term. Okay, with all of that, I'm going to turn it over to our students and to our panel. I know the panels have been sort of up and down, structurally speaking, that is, over the course of the term. Sometimes they've been involved in the class a little, sometimes a lot. We're working these for us to make it a lot, and I understand they'll be involved a lot today, too. So with that, take it away, guys. It's all yours.
Great. Thank you, President Ray. Well, Ed and I cannot promise to be as intelligent or as funny as Jay-Z over here. But we will try to pay more
attention.
We tried, but it was too hard. We would like to just begin talking about this issue. As you see, the internet introduces a lot of really interesting and somewhat unique issues with respect to comparative and international law. And just like to give you an idea of what these issues might be and some of the controversies that that arise as a result of the internet. And with that said, I'd like to just talk to Aaron, who will tell you a little more about what we talked about today. All right, well, welcome everybody. Everybody here is this lab thing working, I've never actually influenced before and wandered around here. We're coming to the edge of the part of the course, as Jay mentioned there, where we're starting to wrap things up. And so as we go over the topic comparative international cyber law, we're going to be tying in things from throughout the course, big themes, little ideas. And we're going to take you on through. Over on the course, as we've gone from topic to topic, notice that we've talked about the world being changed by the internet. The internet comes along, wreaks societal and other changes, and it affects people. And then those people react, and they react with technology and policy and law, as in the technology and politics control, to deal with the new reality brought by the internet. And in this class, we talk a great deal about American policy, perspective, societal effects of the internet. We hinted at some points about what goes on outside of the U.S., but what we're really trying to do here is take a look at a lot of the topics that we brought forth over the course of the class from the perspective of people in other countries and from the perspective of international law, international institutions, and those areas. Now, throughout the world, the internet has brought new information, new channels. We've talked about this a lot. It's also brought with it the English language and culture being someone of an American connection and still be predominantly American. So there are cultural effects abroad on the internet and effects around the world as people enter on the internet and get the information. There are also social instability effects of the internet, and regimes, governments, societies around the world react to this or affected by this. And we're going to take a look at the reactions to these effects of the internet abroad. First, we're going to look at how individual countries react to the internet and its effects on their culture and stability. And we're going to look at two case studies. One will be Singapore, the other will be China. Then we're going to move through the idea of the accession of China to the WTO and start to talk about international law, international institutions, and where they might be in the picture. It's something that we haven't necessarily gotten into so much. And WTO is going to be our case study for that. Now, when we talk about changes in the internet, we bring up our old friend, the internet cloud, as we discuss what the effects are, who they affect, and where these people try to deal with the effects. And so accompanied by our old friend, the cloud, we jump in.
Well, as Eric said, as part of our effort to help bring things together again, of course, we thought we'd bring back the internet cloud and show how some of the applications of the internet cloud perhaps are different when we consider the internet globally, as opposed to perhaps as we have, or most of this course, primarily domestically. The first obvious issue that you may have thought about, but we'd like to reiterate, is the fact that in many cases, the source of internet content may be in a different country than the destination, which again may seem obvious, especially for those of you who have lived or traveled abroad. But legally, this brings about certain issues that we'd like to go into more detail on today. And in fact, as you can see, somewhere in the cloud, internet content can cross legal jurisdictions and political boundaries. And what we'd like to talk about today is what happens when internet content passes through the cloud, crosses legal jurisdictions and political boundaries, and emerges somewhere in the realm of this destination, which you can see here, internet service providers, and the destination, which can be businesses or individual users. Our first case study will be devoted to Singapore and China, two governments that have tried to control access to the internet within their own national borders. And these two governments, the Singapore and the Chinese governments, in very different ways, and with perhaps different levels of success, I tried to regulate our access to the internet before the internet service provider by controlling actual ISPs or by promulgating rules which control ISPs. A second source, or a second storefront, is between ISPs and the destination, which in many cases entails regulating or licensing the use of the internet, whether that be access to the World Wide Web or email. And our second case study will be devoted to the World Trade Organization, which is, as Aaron will discuss later, an intergovernmental organization composed of member states, including the United States, and possibly sometime in the future, China. Now, international organizations like the WTO don't actually, in most cases, control the state of internet content, but in many cases will determine the rules that national governments will have to follow when controlling internet content as it passes from the source, through the cloud, and across national borders, and to the destination. And so that should just give you an idea of how the internet cloud can be seen in a somewhat different way when we're talking about international fair design laws.
All right, that brings me back up. Now we're going to jump in, as I mentioned before, there are effects around the world of the internet, cultural and sort of social stability. To make a pitch at this point, student one class, we're going to try to bring the audience in as much as possible. Please feel free to participate. Please do participate. Otherwise, we're going to end up calling on our friends and people like Chris and Taryn and TJ and Marianne. I'm pretty happy about that. So, jumping in from there, throughout the course of this course, we lauded the internet as a beacon of freedom, a way of information getting around the world, a way to bring all kinds of neat products or just fun toys out to ourselves and to others. And along with
the spread of information. There is a spread of English language, culture, what have you. One of the things we're going to try to get everyone to do in this class is take a look at how people outside the U.S. might view the internet and try to be open to that viewpoint. For the most part of the class here, we've run a very, it almost feels like a 60s mentality of anarchy and freedom and the internet. And that's how a lot of people view the internet. It's great, but in this course, we're just going to try to turn that around a little bit and open people up. So the culture of the internet, I'm going to read a quote from a panelist from 2 years ago who came to speak in this class, Neil Postman. And this was his quote about the U.S. And look at whether we're talking about the internet speaking of freedom or something that might impose cultural imperialism. The quote, Neil Postman. I mean, America is trying to colonize the world. It does it a little differently from the way, say, the British did. The British would send their army, well, their Navy first, then their army, their administrators, and then their educational system, then they conquered two-thirds of the globe. The Americans and their television send their television programs and their media products. They're advertising their design, but of course this is an English language. I don't know if there's much in the long run that can be done to stop English, but this is not to say a disapproving attempt to try to curtail or modify in some way the power of American culture. Now this is an example of perception. People around the world might not entirely see the internet in all cases exactly the way we do. It's, you know, pure freedom, pure information, pure good. That's not to say that it's necessarily true in one way or the other, but this is the perception that's out there. I went to, we read the Why the French Hate the Internet article and try to get an idea of that too much articles. I just want to throw it out there. LLMs, SJPs in the class, other countries, I'm curious, is this post-movement quote representative just kind of a whiny reactionary faction, or is this something that is more of a widespread view? How do people see the internet and American culture abroad in other countries? For anybody who wants to jump in, anyone? Throw it out in the back.
Not as an SJP student, but as a JD from a different country, I'm from Trinidad. And I think that as long as the internet remains something that only the privileged in any given country, third world economy, I'm talking about rather, can access, it's not so dangerous. But where a country like Singapore, for example, opens itself up wholeheartedly to the internet, I think that cultural imperialism becomes a very real danger. It's already happened, I think, for most developing countries in that most of their programming continues to be American-based. Their music tastes and so on are shaped by America. And I think this is just one more broadcast medium, really, which we are not producing the content of, but which we are being exposed to for the most part.
Okay, so it's not only a perception, but moves to actual effect. There is the effect, just like TV and other media, as you said, of bringing that language and culture, etc. abroad.
I think it's interesting that in the article that the French study wrote, the French are very disapproving of American culture, but I think that there are other parts of the world where this import of American culture is actually considered cool and something to aspire to. And in that case, if you take the Postman point of view, it's even more dangerous. It's kind of a brave new world kind of brainwashing that these people are losing their native cultures or they're being attracted to American culture and loving it.
Well, even, okay, so say instead of something that's insidious, it's something that's cool and enticing. Does, for people who are concerned about culture, language, what have you, does that make the effects of the internet any less problematic? Does it make it better if it's just something that's cool as opposed to something that might be, you know, big brotherish, insidious? Is it just true, one to the other?
You want me to follow that up?
Sure, if you want, don't ask any more questions. Oh, let's just real quick, you point out that, you know, maybe it's something that it's cool, it's culture, it's like anything else where we see something on TV or in stores, what have you, it's just something that attracts us, it's something that's a part of our experience. If that experience mostly, or if these cool things are American or English, what have you, does that make the effect any less a concern for people around the world?
Well, I think there are two things. One is, they're doing it voluntarily as part of something that they they want to be a part of it. Maybe the problem goes away, but maybe it doesn't. Or I think you can also take the view that English is language power, and America, whether or not it wants to be there, or America, whether or not other countries want to be there, is very much at the head or at the lead of a lot of the changes that are going on. And so the internet might actually be bringing empowerment to people that are countries.
That's a very good point. And this is kind of debated 7-9 as I have jumped across the internet and across readings, and what's been really found is kind of two perspectives. Is the internet as something that's nice and empowering and providing information, and then the view of the internet as something that is maybe scary, maybe bringing too much of another culture or ideas that are foreign into the system. And there's kind of this balance in these two points of view. Governments around the world, many governments are concerned about this, and they view this as one of the ways in which the United States or Western culture or English or what have you, any other point of view, is maybe affecting their culture, that the internet is one of the vehicles. And so this is one of the things that they react to. And we'll get into some of the ways that they have reacted in terms of politics and technologies a bit, going along with a second way in which people kind of see the internet around the world as maybe having an effect, is that of stability, that of social stability of government, machine, what have you. Leads up to a seven for an interesting case that we talked about, food stamps.
Well, if I may interject, what we were trying to do, what I struggled to do, was pull up some non-English language websites, because in my experiences abroad, one thing that a lot of my non-English speaking friends complain about is that there's simply a lack of quality content in the multitude of languages that are spoken around the world. And I think Americans, and certainly English speakers, are quite spoiled in that way. So given the fact that the internet was born in Northern Virginia and invented by Al Gore, that we've been spoiled that we can find websites on any given topic in our native language, which is not the case in many countries where English is not spoken. And I found that I was stymied by a slow network connection, which I think may actually demonstrate that another problem with access to the internet, it's simply a lack of bandwidth.
I was trying to do some more things this afternoon, and actually just completely unscientific little survey here. I was interested in the difference between pure sort of content sites versus anything that had to do with e-business, because some of the readings obviously were saying that e-commerce is seen as a way forward for a lot of these countries, but they object to a lot of content. I found it kind of ironic that the two non-business sites that I went to, IKEN being one, from what I could tell, correct me if I'm wrong, was not in any other language but English, and Harvard University was not, from what I could tell, in other languages besides English, although they had a very prominently displayed article about how cosmopolitan the university is. And all of the other e-commerce sites that I went to, they were big ones, Amazon, eBay, that kind of thing, and multiple different languages. And I just, I agree that it's not going to go down into all kinds of depth, and there certainly is a lack of different languages on the web, but I find it might be interesting that the e-commerce sites have an incentive to get their message and product out in a lot of different languages.
I know, though, that there's a lot of, or several companies that make translation programs you can just put on your computer that will translate the website into whatever language the program happens to work with. I was wondering if y'all had any idea how prevalent those are in other countries, I know they're available.
They are available. As I think I discovered maybe a couple years ago, they're extremely expensive. And I don't know if you've gone to the office website. There's a quick and dirty translator, which just goes to show, and if you have a translator between any two languages that you may know, you'll find that that's often a lot more difficult than it may seem, simply because these services are extremely expensive, and the automatic or automated methods of doing so are still very inefficient. But that is certainly something that a lot of companies are trying to do, in an effort to expand their consumer base, but also to accommodate those who may want internet content in their own native languages other than English. This is just to quickly show that when we're talking about cultural imperialism, we may not be talking about eating baguettes and drinking the right kind of coffee and eating the right kind of cheese. I think access to the internet and the language, the way that you are able to interpret what you find on the internet has to do with such basic things as the language that content is in. And this LLM is only having a service to turn those, but also inhibit access to the internet to those in many countries, certainly many developing countries, where only the wealthy and the educated have studied English, broader to access the widest variety of internet content. So that's one issue that we spent some time talking about, calling, and we'd like to hear what you have to say about this whole argument concerning cultural disparity is meant to be provocative, and certainly there are many answers or possible responses to this. The second major concern that sovereign governments have regarding the internet has to do with what I guess we would call social and political stability. And as we've seen in this course, there sometimes may be a conflict between free speech, we love free expression, and social stability. We saw this, for example, when we talked about ISP liability and the Nuremberg process. Fortunately, we're not able to pull this up, but as you may recall, the Nuremberg files basically list abortionists, and it's sort of, I guess, a lot of people think, as a hit list of sorts, something very provocative, and it's an explicitly political point of view that that society may not want to allow to be expressed. And that may show that in any country, even one such as the United States, which may profess to be libertarian and in support of the fullest range of free expression, that there may be certain things that the internet might not want to allow certain elements of society to express. Internationally, we can see how the internet, at least in theory, can be destabilizing. Aaron and I, when talking about this, thought of what it would be like if the Iranian government discovered that the Satanic Verses, written by Salman Rushdie, could be found on the internet in Iran. Salman Rushdie being safely in hiding until a few years ago in London, but the Satanic Verses right there for anyone in Iran with access to the internet to read. Another example is actually in the reading that has to do with the banning or the restriction on neo-Nazi websites in Germany. Are there any German LLM students, anyone here? Are you familiar with this topic?
Yeah.
Do you happen to have a big opinion? Just think about it, if I were the only American sitting in a German legal classroom, someone asked me about the Nuremberg files, even if I didn't know what to say, surely, do you have a visceral reaction to it?
Well, I'm not a German.
Of German people enough to support expanding. Go ahead, Tom. Well, I mean, the idea isn't to pick on one country or another, but the idea is to take a look at how countries around the world do react to is how countries around the world do deal with the internet, and it's not just countries around the world. We've seen, as Sarah was mentioning, we see this within the United States as well. Often, in viewing our own laws, I think I at least get the sense that Americans feel, well, we have this free speech point of view, and you know, we really don't regulate anything, although maybe those few things. And the more you think about it, every country around the world might have their own unique societal past or cultural norms, what have you, that might lead people to think regulating one area is natural, whereas others might be less natural. It's just kind of a broadening type of idea that we wanted to introduce people to. We should probably get into kind of go into our example of Lehigh in good stand.
Right, well, actually, an interesting case that was at the very end of one of the articles that we assigned for today, which is extremely interesting and directly related to what we were talking about just last week when maybe half of you were here, has to do with the case of this computer engineer in China who was prosecuted by the Chinese government for disseminating subversive information. Now, this computer engineer, Lehigh, was prosecuted for basically selling email addresses to this internet newsletter, which is published by political dissidents, both within and outside of China. And it's rather ingenious. Basically, this newsletter obtains email addresses of thousands of people, only some of which actually are the intended recipients. So these email addresses are sent to a server overseas and then sent back by email. And what happens when these thousands of people get this newsletter, that those who are actually the intended recipient, those who are in support of political dissent in China, who claim that it's a spam. Why do you need to get this? Because, look, thousands of other people got it, and, well, I don't know where this came from. And This Chinese engineer was prosecuted for selling email addresses to this internet newsletter. Actually, we can pull up the internet newsletter and stop. You can find the line. I'm sure that name looks familiar, and you can probably understand why they chose such a flattering picture of. Leader of China, he had a Chinese Communist Party. Probably just for the sake of it here, to bring that back. So when we talk about Singapore and China, we're talking about two distinct countries, one of which may be more familiar with than the other. We wanted to devote just a few minutes, or actually devote the second part of the course to Singapore and China. And the reason why we're talking about China and Singapore are as follows. One, more most importantly, the two governments that have attempted to control internet access within their borders in a comprehensive way that most Americans find totally commendable. And the reasons that they invoke or that can be invoked to justify this regulation of the internet are cultural preservation, in particular, protection of certain moral values, and the attempt to block certain elements of Western degradation, I think a lot of people say, like whitehouse.com. The second would be political stability and political and social stability and trying to marginalize radical destabilized views, such as many people think should be done in the US with these radical pro-life supporters that Polish German files. And the third actually has to do with national sovereignty. We may not agree with ways that China and Singapore have tried to regulate the internet, but many people argue that sovereign governments are well within their legal rights to do what they please.
And with that said, we'd like to actually introduce a guest, someone who we're very privileged to have here, who will be able to speak on internet regulation in Singapore. Professor Hong is a fellow at the Harvard Information Infrastructure Project at the Kennedy School, I guess the Kennedy School's equivalent to the Berkeley Center, and is a professor in Singapore who has widely published on the topic of internet regulation and censorship, particularly in Singapore, and wanted to give him a chance to speak a little bit about the legal and practical means of controlling internet content in Singapore.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I've given 5 minutes to talk about the subject as well. I'll probably 5 minutes.
We won't come down on that because it will work.
Okay. The internet is regulated in Singapore under the Singapore Broadcasting Authority, the SBA. It is not treated as broadcasting, even though it's under the SBA. My view is that the term, some pristine is seen as being as a regulator of the internet. They are regulated in newest thing. So there's some decision there. Singapore is China of interesting comparison because China looks to two countries for internet regulations, USA and Singapore. They visit Singapore like once a year, they get a briefing from the authorities. And then they look for Singapore, USA. This is the other thing. Okay, on the Singapore side, we have three means of getting access on the internet. One is totally unfiltered access, direct connection to the internet. This is for businesses. You get unfiltered access. The government's view is that business should get whatever they want. It's up to business to regulate their own users. Then there is a filtered access where you pay more money, but you get less content because it's filtered. Right now, it's about, I guess, about 250,000 sites are blocked. They pay a US, of course, a US company, to get the list of porn sites. This is updated monthly. My understanding is that porn sites have created a rate of about 2,000 a week. They need to update this regularly. This filter access is actually not very popular. All the ISPs must provide it. This would be the equivalent of your Christian coalition, that some of these kind of filter access. When I presented this to some people at the EU, they were very receptive. They liked the idea a lot. This is last year. So I guess more people have taken up the idea. The third one, which is most common, so if you are a residential user, it is access. It is filtered through proxy servers, and they filter about 100 sites, what they call high traffic, basically porn sites. I'm not sure, I asked them before, they said it's only 100. You guys know what proxy servers are? Is that one? Okay. Proxy server is a device. It is not intended for censorship. It is intended to speed up internet access. The way to think about it is this. You are on the East Coast. I'm in Singapore. She's in Japan. We all want to access a site in, let's say, Silicon Valley. Okay. So if all of us would access that, hitting the site directly, when you access a site, it does consume some resource on that site. So what would be nice to have would be if there is a site, a setup somewhere in the middle, let's say in Kansas, let's say, and then you would access from Boston to Kansas, from Kansas to Silicon Valley. And if there is this site that's in the middle, what happens is that there's something from Michigan access, you would access Kansas first and then straight away, if it is there, you don't go off. The way to understand it would be, you access from here, Harvard. If Harvard University has this, the content, which is cache, they don't go out from Harvard into the proxy server. The proxy servers are all over the place. There are some free, sort of like free proxy servers. Some systems require, it's a bit technical here, some systems require that you must access the same proxy server. So you type in the proxy server. In Singapore, if you are a residential user, you must access it using a proxy server. Only businesses can access the internet directly to the proxy server. This proxy server has 100 URLs that are blocked. Yeah, this is a high traffic. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, is using a small model. They use a proxy server as well to filter 100 sites. I don't know any other country using that.
It's details where the proxy server from my data, the proxy server, this is the internet service provider. The proxy server would be
between the internet service provider and the destination or else it is at the ISP, so okay, yeah, depending. Actually, I need to turn it to show you that. I'll show you two things. One is how to configure the proxy server, and then I'll show you how to bypass it as well. And I told it to my students, oh, let's scribble that down. Yeah, so it's under references. And so all these are to speed up internet access. The cache is meant to speed up the access. It's all there. And if somebody accesses a one site, you can actually go in and check and see what the access. Processor, okay, this is a direct connection to the internet. It is, I'm told by people in Cisco, it is not efficient. So people at Cisco's networks, they want the proxy servers. So there are two ways. One is a manual configure setup. One that I don't do there is with. You must know the port number. That's where it gets a bit tricky. You must know the port number to type in. Something like that. I'm not sure if it's working, so I won't try to address myself here. But the point is that there are a couple of these. I used to collect a few of these for all information. But when people out there knew that I was collecting it, they said, don't do that, do this type of thing, because the proxy servers are going to get flooded. This is what we call public proxy servers. So in Singapore, I think it's something like this is one ISP. Something like that. And you need to know the precise server to hit, and then you get the server. So what happens is that this is very easy to bypass if you know the proxy server to bypass. Otherwise, not everybody knows. So one guy has done it, split out of web, for everybody to see. I think it's two or three. So the proxy servers can be bypassed. Okay.
Well, we'd like to give a chance to our panel to say a few words. We're extremely lucky to have four wonderful panelists who've agreed to do a little role play, as we always love to do in this class. And these four panelists who are sitting in the back row, trying not to be seen, are playing a different individuals who may have something to say about internet regulation in Singapore. So I just wanted to give them a chance, first of all, to introduce themselves. Sarah, where are you?
My name is Sarah, and I'm a human rights activist.
My name is Jen, and I'm a business person.
My name is Catherine, and I am SBA official. I'm Claire, and I'm just a citizen of Singapore and a parent.
To clarify, the SBA is the Singapore Broadcasting Authority, which is responsible for regulating the internet in Singapore. So with that said, I would just like to ask the four of you, how do you feel the current regime in Singapore could be justified or criticized? Maybe I can ask our resident American human rights and free speech advocate.
You want me to justify the
rules? Well, what is your view on internet regulation in Singapore as we see it today?
I think that the rules in Singapore violate free speech values that I hold near and dear to my heart. I think that for the citizens of Singapore, these rules prevent Singaporean citizens from accessing information that they, as human beings, have a right to.
And what do you have to say about this, our fellow SBA, Singaporean government official?
We have a response to that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd say that human rights activists, I admire their really passion and their hard work and whatever, but they should understand that they don't stand for universal values and that Singaporean values are very different, and therefore regulation of the internet and its content should be very different from the way Americans or other Western liberal democracies do it.
Well, let's ask someone who's actually affected by this. We've got lucky enough, a mother of three beautiful Singaporean children, and a Singaporean citizen, someone who will be directly affected by the discussion we're having now. What do you think about this?
I mean, I think, as we sort of read in the article that we read about Singapore, that the majority of citizens, at least the ones polled by the, some sort of broadcasting channel, the majority of them support regulating violence and pornography on television and in the press. And it seems to me from what we read about the SBA's regulations of the internet that they're sort of pretty well thought out and that they can sort of consult with the industry and that there are filters made available and the ISPs have to make them available to families, but it doesn't really seem as though they're shut down the throats of families. And though they express concern about sort of seditious material, their primary concern in their sort of restated code of practice seems to be pornography and violence. And I think even in this country, we've seen a lot of people who are interested in filtering technology to keep that kind of stuff away from their children.
And finally, we have I'm not quite sure, a venture capitalist.
Yes, I'm a venture capitalist.
Okay, so we have a VC in the audience. Are you Singaporean or?
Yes.
You are a local venture capitalist. Do you think that that internet regulation in Singapore in any way impinges on the future of internet development or e-commerce or anything related developments within Singapore?
Well, I do think that to a certain extent it limits the success potential of certain business models. For example, if you want to use encryption, you have to receive prior written approval, so encryption is important to your business model, and if you don't receive that permission, that would obviously be really troubling. Also, since it does fall under the purview of the SBA, since the broadcasting medium, if you want advertising revenue to be an important part of your business model, you're also subject to the SBA regulations for that. But that said, the SBA has been responsive to industry concerns. For example, it did revise a code of practice when we requested clarification. And they also have the Internet Advisory Committee that takes into considers the feedback of industry as it makes policy. And also the Singapore One, no one's really talked about that yet, but it's going to be the world's first national broadband network. And there are huge potentials for wireless connections with that, and that's one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in investing.
So as a local VC, it sounds like you're pretty much willing to let it off, to take advantage of the status quo.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, as the professor said, businesses aren't subject to some of the SBA requirements in their content, their internet content providers, and their access to the internet is unfiltered. That's one of the needs of internet access to this stuff. Although, if businesses provide internet access to their employees, it's again, sort of the whole idea of the light touch and self-regulation. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity.
Great. Well, we're going to get back to you. I'd like to hear yourself back there. Last week we distributed a bot question, thanks to Becca. And I know that all of you sat down on Thanksgiving break and spent hours working on this.
in fact, I'd ask if anyone sat down in the public office tried to place itself in the shoes of the chairman of the Singapore Broadcasting Authority and considered perhaps any changes in the current internet regime. Or, you know, as we see in our next question, how would you respond to U.S. ambassador claiming that internet regulation in Singapore is undemocratic and unfair and it's simply too much censorship? Did anyone actually think about this? Yeah, Claire.
Well, your question talked about, or sort of compared this to, like in France, they say 40% of everything on television has to be French produced or something like that. And from what I could gather from what we read about Singapore, that kind of sort of cultural quota didn't seem to really be the kind of regulation that they were going for. I mean, they're sort of interested in blocking a sort of, you know, protecting the moral purity of their citizens. They didn't seem too concerned about sort of making sure that, you know, half of what people got on the internet was, you know, from Singapore itself. And maybe that's because in France, you know, they don't have these sort of tight controls that Singapore has, so they have to use regulations like this, they feel like, to protect their culture. Whereas in Singapore, they have already these tighter regulations, so they don't need a sort of quota like France has.
Anyone else?
Just to echo the view of one of the panelists just now about why Singapore targets porn as one of the things it wants control over the internet. Just to give an example, over, I think in the early 1990s, the government tried to allow they call R-rated movies in Singapore, right? You know, minimal censorship of movies, this nudity, the sex, this violence. And what happened after that within 3 months was there was a huge outcry about how people in Singapore are generally conservative about such issues. So sentinel is that the government should not allow them to come in as such a free rate. So what happened is the government introduced legislation that cut the age, or actually that raised the age of watching R-rated movies from 18 to 21. They just go to show that sentiment in Singapore is generally that, you know, that's not a viewpoint in a very favorable light, and sentiments are that people do want porn to be regulated, and as well as other objectionable material. So my view is that the way the Singapore government is trying to uphold the market sector, and that it's not just shoving it down the throat of the consumers, but rather seeing what the market wants, which is doesn't want uncensored information coming in and trying to go along with that.
Okay. I actually have a question along those lines, which could either be for Professor Ong or for our venture capitalist in the back, which is, a lot of the readings seem to focus on the effects or lack of effect of the content-based restrictions on e-commerce and the growth of an internet industry in the affected countries. And I was wondering if there were any information on whether or not foreign investment or domestic investment in new technologies or new companies had been affected in any way by the regulation, or if there's another metric that you could judge it by other than investment that might suggest whether or not e-commerce or the internet industry growth have been affected.
I'm actually looking into this area. There's an Internet Society conference coming up, Stockholm in June, and I'm putting a panel to look at the effects of censorship. So far in Singapore, we haven't seen that. In fact, the authorities are concerned, strange. They want to allow gambling on the internet because people are taking cruise ships out, international waters, and gambling. So they figure losing millions of dollars. So what if they then do it on the internet? But as you might know, Australia is actually trying to chase out gamblers. Either two things, either chase them off or else regulate them so that you get really, really well-run casinos on the internet. In Korea, Korea is the hottest dot-com gambling place in Asia. They have the most bizarre censorship rules where they actually deleted messages and my 96 paper, I estimated they must have deleted about a million messages that were posted on the internet. A million messages. They have a rule that if you meet a non-woman over the internet, you must report to the police. If you meet a naked woman over the internet, that's okay. But the non-woman, that's dangerous. Yet that is really, really happening. They have the fastest growth of IP addresses domain names in Asia the last year. So it doesn't seem like there is any decline, but I'm presenting that to the panel to look at this.
Okay. I thought in that if Singapore's economy is growing as an IT economy so much despite all the censorship, doesn't that place an incredible burden on the state, on the government to be in essence a benevolent dictatorship? I mean, we read about the government's ability to suppress dissent and to control popular opinion, to really foster this belief that the government of Singapore is infallible. But having created that belief, doesn't that give the leaders the incentive to skim off the top where it's possible and to enrich themselves, because dissent is completely suppressed and because the press is completely at the heel of the government has, there's no independent check on whether the government is actually as perfect as it may set up to be. Now, that may not have stunted economic growth thus far, but is it reasonable to expect that at some point that these governments in court are going to be perpetually benevolent and that these leaders will not ultimately try and act in their own self-interest?
Is there a question like that?
Only question.
Well, I think without delving into Singaporean politics, that's precisely what former Prime Minister people like you spoke at Kennedy School just a few weeks ago, would argue that this prestige of democracy in Singapore is based on sort of benevolent dictator. But one argument that is made against the current regime in Singapore is, I think, somewhat along different lines, that simply because the Singaporean government, the SPA, so tightly controls internet service providers, that they are able to perpetuate monopoly on access to the internet. This is a huge issue in China. That the Chinese government simply due to its monopoly on internet service providers. It's trying to control, is able to basically set the scale off the top. But I think there are those who argue that the benefits of making sure that these social and political values are preserved are worth any economic costs. Okay.
China has
spread
more misinformation since I've learned that I can't, and Harvard are both have multilingual sites. But my comment had to do with the fact that when I was working this summer with the .com, we met with the Singapore trade delegation, and among the competitors for the .com, I was the one that was in the food industry. Singapore was the hottest place to be going if you were going to be looking into Asia. And that was because of all of the both IT investment and other types of investment that were just mentioned. They had an incredible amount of logistics support, and the government seemed to be really trying to make it very easy to encourage e-commerce users to come in. So perhaps that's a way that they're trying to balance that out. It's certainly true in this particular food industry, which is this heavy type of industry.
Okay.
I want to go back to your question, the Bob question.
Sure.
And we've all sort of taken as a given the assumption, or seems that we have in the article, that most of the people polled agreed with the limitations, and your comment on the digital engineering that when they tried to bring in the RWBs, there was a clamor of the people not to have them there, and the government responded, in kind by increasing the agents. So it's unclear to me that that's the type of sort of democratic upsurge of beliefs that we would want to see. If it's really the will of the people to limit content on the internet or to limit movies or access they have, that's one thing. And your sort of community has a right to make a more, I would say, it has a right to make a set of moral judgments about the type of environment it wants to foster. But I would question, I just want to be certain that the people making those decisions are educated and know their options and have had a chance to think through and argue about the different possibilities, and there's voice given to dissent in a way that could lead to a real dialogue on this, the ultimate consensus, or lack of consensus, and that would be respected as well. It's not clear to me from what I've read that's the case, and I think that calls into question then the validity of the community sense of morality and exactly how much of a benevolent dictatorship this is at all.
I would say due to lack of time that it's probably safe to say that it has a perspective. But maybe we can explore these issues further when we talk about our second case, which is China, which is perhaps an even more fascinating case. Just for those of you who might not be familiar with Singapore, let alone China, basically the differences between Singapore and China with respect to China relations are pretty stark. The other fact that they're both predominantly Chinese culturally and ethnically, they're extremely different countries. First has to do with the wealth of Singapore versus China. Singapore actually has a per capita GDP of nearly $29,000, which is comparable to the United States. In fact, many people have told me that Singapore is by far the nicest, neatest, most immaculate city that they've ever seen in their lives. Whereas China, on the other hand, despite its great economic potential, has a per capita GDP of $708, which compared to the United States GDP of nearly $34,000, it is quite a bit less. So that's one issue. The second difference has to do with the population of these two countries. Singapore actually has a population of just 4 million, which is maybe the size of Boston and whereas China, you know, is the single most populous country in the world, with a population now of nearly 1.25 billion people, probably 4 or 5 times larger than the United States. So this represents a potentially enormous market without parallel. And the reason why, when we talk about e-commerce, a lot of VCs and entrepreneurs start salivating because of the potential, future potential of this market. This year, just gives you a sort of brief overview of the legal and technical means for regulating the internet in China. As you can see here, the primary ISP is ChinaNet, which is controlled by China Telecom, which is a government agency. That means that ChinaNet can, by itself, block IP addresses. And in addition, the Chinese government requires the licensing of ISPs. Furthermore, the registration, Chinese government, at least by law, requires individuals to register when they sign up for Gmail accounts or ISP accounts. And finally, these, I'd say two lesser factors are monitoring of internet traffic, which is possible because of the monopoly on ISP service. And the second is the attempt to sort of create this national internet, which has been proven largely unsuccessful. You can imagine the United States is sort of explode the internet without access to the rest of the world. That's essentially what China has attempted to do with nominal success. Actually, I have a couple of panelists and a few other people I know who have spent time in China. And I was wondering if you could sort of tell us a bit about what it's like to access or to try to obtain access to the internet, despite this regulation that we see here on paper. Anyone like to type up? I know that there are a few of you here, and I think folks are sort of interested to see the difference between what we see in the black letter law and what actually happens in practice, which is often quite different. Here's Jack Adler.
One thing, I was in China from 96 to 98, and just some interesting changes that I saw when I was there was that first it was very difficult to get internet access. Even as a foreigner, where you feel like there's fewer regulations over what to do, it was hard. There were a lot of things you had to jump through. But the semester that I came back to the States, this fall of 98, I heard that the university where I was teaching, I just got a grant from the Hong Kong Foundation to wire every single dorm room to the internet, which was incredible to me because I don't think they have heat and air conditioning in these dorm rooms, and they're living like 6 to 8 people per room. On the other hand, I think that there are serious issues with regard to firewalling, and I know that this is just totally linked to my personal experience. After the death of Deng Xiaoping in the spring of 97, it wasn't just the internet that got heavily and very heavy-handedly censored, but all broadcast media, television, cable TV, radio, everything. Tons of things that had been available before were no longer available. And then, you know, I think 6 months to a year later, they became available again. I've heard that you can't access CNN from China, but I also despite the government's best efforts to make it difficult to access things, that there are people who are able to. So I don't really know the state of internet access there. I think that you might find pockets of very, very strict control, like in areas closer to Bay Area. And I think that maybe the farther away you get from that central locus of power, maybe the looser control are.
I was in China last year, and I have to say that I found it sometimes a little finding easier to find an internet cafe or find access to the internet than to find local, and it was really incredible. I mean, there are so many, there's just so much, it's just booming, and that was last year, like this year. And I have no trouble accessing websites like CNN or the New York Times. Not at all. So that's just my personal opinion.
So there you go. We've got the two examples of maybe the ineffectiveness of internet regulation in China, some of the enormous legal and technical difficulties that the Chinese government is trying to control the state of internet content. Sarah?
Well, maybe the Chinese government has had trouble blocking sites, but they certainly haven't had problems for tracking people. Tracking destinations, and I think that last year, and again, I'm speaking as a human rights activist, last year, the crackdown on Falun Gong was based, I think a lot of the information came based on tracking emails and based on tracking websites that were attached to this religious movement. So while perhaps they're unable to block access to these sites, they certainly haven't had a problem with identifying the users who were going and using things that they deemed subversive.
That's a very good point, and it goes to show that perhaps perhaps legally or technically easier to do one thing versus another.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with that. It's actually true that if you're, for example, registered at the university, or if you have a registered email address, then it seems like they do, it almost seems like they read every single email that you send. And I've had people who couldn't send emails if they said something that was to the disadvantage of Chinese politics, and it's in
it's fantastic. How did, when you say that it felt like they were being on emails, how did you know what gave you that?
That did happen to me, but it happened to people I knew that they couldn't transmit the email, like it wouldn't bounce back. They said you couldn't send it. I don't know if that was just coincidence, but it happened to people. And
well, we decided to devote the last part of the class to a case study at WTO, and what makes this especially compelling is China's relationship with the WTO, which has been in the headlines recently. I think I'd like to turn this over to Aaron to bring this up.
Sorry, we have to move on from the discussion. It's been interesting. I hope people will take that on more, maybe even behind the professor on after class, and get some information on what's going on in China. We could contact there right now. China is moving in an interesting direction. It seems that the reality on the ground, as we mentioned, might have been a little bit freer than what you might see in the laws. At the same time, recent reports indicate that the regime in China might be tightening up their regulation a little bit. Then they crack down on cyber cafes in Beijing. There have been new rules on encryption. Somebody talked about earlier in the class, limiting American-style encryption, maybe encouraging encryption where the government would have access or a key, so to speak. So these are all things that might be pointing to maybe a little bit tighter view on the internet. On the other hand, in recent session talks with the World Trade Organization, China has been talking with major trading partners around the world with view towards joining in the WTO. And as that process works, they meet with the European Union, the United States, Brazil, others, and talk about what concessions they would make, how they would open up their trade and other laws to encourage people to allow them access to WTO. And there are a number of commitments made, particularly to the United States, over the next several years after accession, 2 to 6 years after accession, that would open up ownership of internet, telecommunications, and other companies and providers up to 49 or 50%. So there may be conflicting pressures. We might be closing up, we might be opening up. There's still a lot to be seen from China. But moving on, what we see with the WTO and China is an example of how an international organization, when a national institution framework, can affect the way the internet is regulated in a given country. And that's not something that we've talked about a great deal in this class. I know that we discussed ICANN, which in a lot of ways ESA is an institution, international institution, although it is in the United States, and instead of a public company here. But there are a number of international institutions, organizations that might start to have a role in the WTO. Under the UN, and its trial in 1996, put together model e-commerce rules. The ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, has a long regulatory role in radio, satellite, and other regulations. I've actually mentioned in the past my own views that eventually ICANN might end up in the ITU. That's all speculation, but that might be something that we have 10 years down the road. We'll see. That's my own prediction. I might be right, I might be wrong. But there are international institutions that might have a role to play. Particularly, we're going to talk about the WTO. And I'm curious to your reactions. I know that Angela brought this up first with Professor Zittrain. As far as I saw, there was somewhat of a heterogeneous reaction to WTO involved in the internet. That doesn't sound quite good. I'm curious just what people heard on the TV in Seattle, what have you, what people's reaction to the idea that the WTO might have some role to play in the internet might be. So we'll go pump if anybody would think that something that might be positive. People how many people are hesitant or apprehensive or think that might be a really bad thing? It's hard to gauge comments at this time of night, but my sense is that that was a more of a negative maybe a little bit of open-minded. So we're jumping into the WTO and the role it has to play in the internet. Around the world, one of the things that's really driving the growth of the internet, along with the importance of information, what have you, is the role of commerce. There's money to be made, there are things to be sold, there's business to be done over the internet. And when you talk about commerce and business and trade, you talk about an area where the World Trade Organization might have a role to play. Now, people might have heard about the WTO, seen it on the news. I'm curious, how many people have some vague background, or think they know what the WTO is or does, or what have you, so I know how much background to go with. Okay, so that's not bad. Speaking of a general view, WTO is there. In any case, just to demystify the WTO, the World Trade Organization, really what you're talking about is it's a series of treaties between the major trading countries around the world, increasingly developing in other countries. The original treaty was GATT, 1947. That is General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that deals with goods, whether it's a magazine or a steel beam or what have you, that passes in between countries and rules governing that. More recently, the WTO was created and expanded the Nuremberg Round. So these are just the foundational treaties. You have GATT, which is trade with goods. GATS, with its general agreement in trade and services, that is the agreement on what the trading responsibilities and rules are for services, whether it's be banking or accounting or law firms or various other services. TRIPS is trade-related aspects of intellectual property, and there are other agreements, trends, investment, and various other annexes, and so on. WTO actually has an administration that kind of ties all this together, the General Council, made up of the members, what have you, and they actually have a court, which is this settlement body that actually, when disputes come up under the treaty, it's usually about how a trade should go, if they can actually bring it to a decision. So that is basically all the WTO is. It's a series of treaties that create responsibilities with regards to trade. And the question is, does this have anything to do with the internet? How does trade or this whole framework of the international organization led to anything we talk about in this class? And the WTO seemed to think so. In May of 1998, the group of nations decided that there was a whole lot of trade going on the internet, and they were going to launch a program
and an interest selling on e-commerce. That's they said they would put together a program on e-commerce, and they were going to look at issues of taxation of internet goods around the world, intellectual property, how it affects developing nations. They were really going to jump in and get involved. And this is something that seems to be kind of under the radar. I don't hear a lot about it, but there seems to be a lot of interest, and this is something that they're really looking at heavily. Now, oddly enough, the one big issue that they all got seemed to be bogged down or stuck in is something that might seem kind of technical and pointless. But we're going to talk about it today and try to figure out if maybe it has some meaning, could shed some light on what the role of the WTO is and why we should bother to care about it in the internet class. So they got bogged down the various numbers that we're looking at it, what they're trying to decide, what digital products being an MP3 instead of a CD, a DVD instead of a movie, a Blue Mountain card instead of a Hallmark card, and just a digital equivalent of a good that we think about every day. They were trying to figure out whether that should be a good or a service. And for some reason, this is something that's really stuck. And after a full year, in July 1999, the General Counsel got reports from all the people in the WTO who were looking at this, and it said that this one issue is mired in disagreement. And this is what we're going to take a look at, a little bit of mystery, and see if we can work our way through. A lot of people might look at that, a lot of people might care. Just give you a little background, I'm going to jump into some actual class participation and textual analysis. We're doing something basically you have people who might be interested for different reasons. Right now in Europe, the European Union is taking a strong stance that these digital products are services. Their line is that it's intangible, anything that's intangible is a service, and anything that is a service is a gas. Right now, the law says that service VATs, the taxation in Europe is value-added taxes, that service VATs apply to these digital products as opposed to goods VATs. Now, service VATs are hovering in the range between 14 and low 20%. Taxation. Goods VATs are closer to the 5% range. So there's a real difference in that. That's one of the reasons that people might posit why, for example, the European Union feels so strongly about this. The U.S. on the other side stating the position that perhaps these digital goods should be viewed as goods and subject to GATT and treated a little bit differently. So that's kind of the conflict right now. So taxation might be one reason why you might take this view, but another is content. And that's where we're going to lean in and take a look at what some of the differences are, why that actually matter, why, in the long run, these digital products are goods or services. General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, this is the GATT. You probably heard about this in the news and the talks about Seattle, what have you. This is just the agreement on goods. And when goods are traded around the world, there are certain rules. One of the major ones is national treatment. Basically, once any good that's subject to the GATT from America or any other country goes to any other member country, whenever there is trade between two members of the WTO, that good has to be treated under tax and under laws and regulations the same way in that country as domestic products. So if I export a CD, you have to treat it the same way as a CD from your country. We'll look at the language up here. Internal taxes and other internal charges, laws, regulations, requirements should not be implied. Social support protection, products of any contract and products imported to any territory. The contract party should be accorded treated no less favorable than imported like products in respect of all laws, regulations, etc. Now, this is the GATT. And if these digital products are seen as goods, they are subject to these GATT rules, which are a good bit stronger. The GATT has been around since 1947, we have case law, there are a lot of agreements, people have a pretty good idea of how to treat goods. Now we switch over to GATT, I'm going to throw it out of the class. In the sector described in the schedule, and subject to any condition and qualifications set out there, each member shall accord services and service suppliers, any other member treated no less favorable than that in accordance with its own like services and service suppliers. Now, on the face, it seems to be pretty similar to the GATT, but there is a trick. It's Well, Professor Joseph Wilder points out the difference between lawyers and other professions is our knowledge of law that we read carefully. So I'm going to go around and see if there's anybody who can figure out within this text where there is a difference in the language. Why this, why the GATS might be a little bit different than the GATT. Any brave souls? Both of them. But both have come out. There you go. There's an art to this Socratic thing. That's just a train that I don't know if the Socratic thing is a good or a service, actually. Okay, well, let me just go against the barrel for a long time. In the sectors described in its schedule, in GATT, it is all goods. In GATS, it is in the sectors described in its schedule that have to be treated with national treatment or treated the same. So basically what that says is that if a country hasn't specifically agreed in its schedule to treat a certain type of product of national treatment, they're not bound to do so under the GATS treaty. And this was a big deal because the Uruguay round, certain countries did not want certain services to be included. They weren't sure they were ready for national treatment in these kind of services. One of the ones that there was no agreement on was audiovisual services, the movies or music or anything else audiovisual. So we're going to, knowing we know of GATT and GATS, I'm going to throw out just some quick typos on trade and see if we can get to why this might matter, might be of interest to the internet. You have a, see, we're going to talk about a magazine. A U.S. magazine is sold in Canada. Any Canadians, you can tell me a Canadian magazine. Canadians? Canadians, we have Canadian soon, a Canadian magazine. So we have Canadian Weekly sold in Canada, and we have Sports Illustrated sold in the center of the United States to be sold in Canada. Under those rules, under the rules of being that so product is a good, can that magazine be treated any differently? Can Sports Illustrated be treated any differently than Canadian Weekly? Okay. No, and the call out answer. So we have that magazine has to be treated the same way. Now, how about a CD? We send a Ricky Martin or a Britney Spears CD out to be sold in Canada. And the local product of Bare Naked Ladies and Honest North Set is competing. Do they have to treat those the same? Yeah. Okay. It's not a yes. Those are good, they have to be treated the same. But now what if this was on the radio? If they were playing these songs on the radio, do they have to treat everything the same, assuming that there is no agreement on audiovisual or music or what have you?
No.
Thank you. So they don't have to treat it the same. It is a service, and content controls are allowed. And we saw this, if you remember from the registry question, some of the rules that are around the world. In Europe, for example, the Television Without Frontiers initiative says that at least 50% of the programming on TV has to be from originating from a European maker of the program. In Canada, they could, in fact, say that a certain number of songs, you can't play all of Britney Spears and Ricky Martin, at least a third to 33% of daytime radio songs have to be reserved for Canadian artists. Australia, 55% for local television. You have these around, and it seems to be that they're more so in developing Western countries. And this is another one of the reactions that we talked about. Not necessarily at the internet, but the reaction to other countries to U.S. culture abroad. That there are some countries who want to maintain outlets for their culture, and that's something that is staying. And the question is, how does this apply to the internet? Can people see that maybe this has some role to play? Oddly enough, in areas where the WTO has a stronger regulation, where it's GATT or it's good, there is actually less ability of local law to regulate content or to get involved in discrimination. So kind of an odd sort of way of trying to paint, and I hope it wasn't so excruciating, was with the WTO, one of the paradoxes of the WTO is stronger WTO regulation as an international body, as part of international law, can often mean less regulation at the national level because of the obligations involved therein. And so knowing that, we'll throw it out again, knowing that aspect, how many people now think that maybe it's not such an awful thing for the WTO to be involved in the internet? Anybody who's changed their mind? Okay, quiet. I'll raise your hand. But in any case, let's move on to just the kind of long way of trying to demonstrate that maybe our initial reaction to the WTO wasn't such a bad thing, or it wasn't, or the WTO itself, excuse me, wasn't as bad as we may think. But then again, there's some more things that we should think about. I just want to throw up here real quick, talk about the good services dispute. Because I think that we'll find something interesting about the nature of technology and what it is doing for the WTO. So, Andrea, what's up?
I have a question.
Sure.
What is the rationale for changing the good services exactly?
Okay. The rationale originally the trading partners that got together only had an agreement on goods. Services were viewed as something separate. They didn't have specific rules on it. Often that's because service is something that's done, particularly in that reference center, something that was done within a country, whether it be a haircut or law or what have you. It's more something that was done within the country over time. With the growth of globalization, there was more of an opportunity for different service providers to actually play a role in other countries. So services was brought up, but there were a number of concerns about what would happen if services were regulated like goods were. A little bit of protectionism, people were concerned about their own local banks or law firms or what have you. So it's just a little bit differently, and you saw the reaction to the audiovisual people. A number of countries, particularly European countries, wanted to maintain a little bit, or at least the ability to have some cultural or other control or protection. So that was a little bit of the reasoning.
Maybe I'm totally wrong, but I thought that the services received more protection because, not in deference to sort of local bankers, but actually in deference to like Merrill Lynch's of the world. So like you force the goods providers to exist in the free market such that like you hurt the small guys and protect the big guys from services. And maybe this is my human rights oriented view of the World Trade Organization treaties, but I don't know if I think that your analysis of services protection is right.
Okay, well, it's certainly opening for other views. I'm just kind of
paragraphing. Well, maybe totally more than I knew about it, but that was my understanding of the actual the way the protection works.
But we've got the goods protection stronger than the in a lot of ways. Well, that's kind of relative valuation. The GATT would provide a stronger set of rules than the GATT would. So goods is stronger than services. Services is newer. There's not enough, as much precedent. As you saw, there have to be agreements or schedules for these things to apply. Does that make sense?
I don't know if it was right, but that's my memory. Of course, I've learned the WTO in a Western institution,
there's a lot of conflicting views on the WTO and the motives behind it existing right now.
I was looking at this from a sort of, we were discussing this back here, the difference I think in our perspectives is that you're looking at
if you're looking at it from a sort of international perspective, and that's where that I'm looking at the protection from the orientation of a local person. So that goods are less protected than services are, because you can't discriminate between goods, between national and international goods. With services, you can. And so my understanding was that my understanding was that the reason that basically the services got a better deal because of big banks, and like the big Merrill Lynch's of the world. People may definitely know where I'm
from. Oh, no, I know there's there are a plethora of views out there. I'm sure Val Nader would see the WTO very differently than Charlene Marchesi. Take a little more comment and just jump in rather than subs, because we're almost out of time. Brian?
On the WTO website, they actually explain why GATS is different than GATT. And it says here, under what is the main purpose of GATS? While services had long been considered to offer less potential for trade expansion than goods, given myriad technical, institutional, and regulatory barriers, this view has been confounded by the introduction of new technologies facilitating the supply of services, e.g. satellite communications, the opening in many countries of long-entrenched monopolies, e.g. voice telephony, and the gradual liberalization of hitherto restricted sectors like banking and insurance. So it was, according to some version there, the difference between the regulation of trade and regulation of services.
Much more articulate way of putting it than I was able to originally. That's terrific. Now we do accept your problems. So I want to get everybody out here on time. Let me see if we can have you cut them over. Just to quick wrap up. The dispute does rage over whether digital products should be goods or services. There are all kinds of standards out there that people are throwing out, arguments one way or the other. This principle that came under the telecommunications agreement, that technology neutrality is a general principle of WTO, that trade rules should not favor one technology over another. So that's one thing that's pushing. The general focus of the WTO is towards less restrictions on trade, so that essentially you'd want the definition to be least restrictive on trade. So these are some of the things that are pushing it. The arguments basically going on between the US and the EU and other players. When you get into it, it's interesting. One side will argue that all intangibles should be services. It's easier. It's within tax regime easier. US would argue that, we want to treat like products alike, and that really a CD is really similar. It's really like to a MP3, and the movie is really similar to a DVD, and that an e-book by Stephen King is really similar to the same book if you were to put it up on paper and sell it. And so those things should be treated similarly. As you argued out, they get into gray areas. I'd love to engage in a discussion on this. We'll be right out of time. You can get into gray areas. For example, MP3s. You have music, you buy a CD, it's a good. If you have the same music on a radio, it's a service. Now what happens if we move into the world of the future of Napster, which might well be you have to buy a subscription. And with that subscription, you can download these songs. Is that a good or is that a service? Similar to, say a DVD you have, or a movie, you see a movie in the theater, it is a service clearly. If you go to Walmart and buy the recent hot movie just as an entity, that's a good. But then again, if you go to Blockbuster and rent it, it kind of layers being more of a service again. And this is one of the big conflicts that the new technology in the WTO presents. Now, back to our good friend Singapore, all the different countries in the WTO or many of the major trading partners put in position statements of what they think the policy should be, what their own values espoused are with regards to the WTO, and far and away, the most sophisticated submission of any country was a joint submission from Indonesia and Singapore. And this is what they had to say. They had to say that maybe these digital products are not really goods or services. Maybe they don't fit in these pre-existing categories, and maybe we shouldn't try to force them in there. Maybe what you really have with a digital product, a DVD, a book online, is pure intellectual property. And what is happening when these are traded online, what's happening when these are traded online is you're really licensing intellectual property. And so this is an issue of intellectual property. What you're saying is you can use my MP3 in Thailand, and you can read my book, your Stephen King, in England. And so we're really not dealing with the literary service, but we're just dealing with the licensing of intellectual property. And this is a huge challenge because the WTO simply can't account for that.
To wrap up here, I hope that we provided at least a semblance of an introduction to some of the complex issues that we've talked about today. As you can see, the foreign governments and international organizations like the WTO are grappling with these issues, and you can see where the conflicts may lie. And hopefully in the next several classes, we'll be able to explore these issues, and perhaps we'll be able to see some of the issues we've talked about in this class now from the perspective of international and comparative cyber law. And with that said, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, so
thank you very much to our guests from HIIP for coming across the river, or at least across Harvard Square, and joining us. Thanks to these guys. It's a daunting task, and you guys have listened to it. Thank you very much. I'm going to send you guys an email with sort of the schedule for the rest of the sessions we have, three sessions remaining. I wish you good luck on the papers as you round the bend on those. And we'll see you same bat time, same bat channel tomorrow for the argument over DECSS. It's after only with video. Good night.